Welcome to Nationalist Public Radio, Words from the End of the West, with your hosts, Everett Foster, Roderick Kane, James Price, and Brett Stevens.
Hello, everybody. This is James Price with Nationalist Public Radio here, and today I am joined by Brett Stevens. Say hello, Brett.
Greetings.
And today we're covering a long-awaited episode that we wanted to fixate on the alt-right, our sort of flavor of the alt-right here at America.org. And we recognize that the alt-right is conflicted with a lot of divergent philosophies here. So we have a lot of groups divided through belief systems, such as National Socialism, Neo-Reaction, and the short-sightedness of textbook white nationalism. So what we're looking to focus on in this episode specifically is the position that we'd unite much of what these groups are looking for and taking it a step further through some key pillars that we look at in America, which include culture, aristocracy, hierarchy, transcendental outlook, and quality. So Brett, why don't we start on culture, if you could summarize. What is the problem here? What is the position that America takes on this?
What we are trying to do is get out of an evil time known as modernity. Modernity is defined by the fact that we have a mass of equal people who are ruled by an external government that is not formed of them, but is designed to manage them, much as your manager manages you at work. And if we're going to escape this, what we want is not another system, but an escape from systems. We need a different type of society and a different design for the type of society we have. For that reason, we're going to get away from the model of having government do everything for us and control us, and instead look toward a situation where most decisions are made by individuals within the group based on cultural values. So instead of looking toward universal values that are common to all of humankind, we're looking toward very specific values that are entirely based in that civilization and for its own purposes and for its own furtherance. And so when we say we need rule by culture, that means a few things. One, you're not going to have an all-powerful government. Two, you need a cultural group. You cannot create this group with ideology or a financial system like capitalism or socialism. What you need to do is have people who are born of the same root, who share the same basic abilities and outlook on life, because that is how they've evolved and what their ancestors have valued, and therefore what has shaped them. We are the people of the past going into the future. And for this reason, we need strong nationalism, which is not so much racial as it is ethnic. You find a very similar group of people who, for example, in Western civilization, share the root of Western civilization, which is a Nordic Germanic origin, and you put them together and basically get government and other external managerial forces out of the picture so that they can rule themselves by enforcing values on one another. For example, some things would be seen as unacceptable, and everyone around you would want nothing to do with them because they would not fit within the parameters of that culture and would not be helpful to that culture. They would not aid in its growth and in nurture it toward becoming a better version of what it is. This is entirely alien to modern people who are accustomed to laws, and they're accustomed to having government do things for them and make changes in their lives to socially engineer them and shape them toward acting out the will of an ideology, which is presumed to be good for them, but in fact, because it's written in a universal context, because it deals with this idealized equal human being, really has nothing to do with who they are. And so when we say culture rule, we imply a strong nationalism that separates the ethnic group out from all others. They must dwell alone, as the saying goes, and then separates out from them those that cannot uphold the values of that culture. So you are looking for people born of a common root, with a common belief, but even more with common customs. They behave the same way, roughly. They have the same values, roughly. They have the same abilities, roughly. In this way, you do not have this vast problem with inequality or with massively aberrant behavior, because everyone understands that there are some basic values to which they all adhere, and because of that, everything else is basically wide open. So it is more anarchic in many ways, but it's also more like you would expect a group of hunters or military men or people collaborating on an artistic project would behave. There have to be core values, there has to be a purpose, goals, and a direction. So when we say culture rule, this is what we mean.
Let's move on to aristocracy. This is something you write about every so often, or anarcho-monarchism. And I suppose so people are caught up in the trap that, okay, this is an archaic system, we had the French Revolution, everyone will get slaughtered in the end. I don't know, what's your sort of viewpoint? Like, is something as alien and modern as the way the United States is right now, for example, what would even the process even look like to return to a style ruled the best in aristocracy, and why is that a good thing for our audience?
The main advantage of aristocracy is that you're taking, instead of giving the people who have the most money the power, you're taking the people who are the best among you, and you are entrusting them with wealth and power, so they have no interest in gaining further wealth and power. They completely have everything they need, and they are fully satisfied, and their only chance of success, instead of accumulating more money, is by ruling well and by being exemplars of this civilization from which they come. And so, in America right now, we have a democratic republic, a form of liberal democracy, and for us to get to an aristocracy, we would really need to transition from this formal leadership to an informal type of leadership. That would involve change in government, such that we would possibly have a constitutional amendment, which would provide for aristocracy, and it would require a seed group, a number of people who are acknowledged as excellent, and as people who understand this vision and can implement it, and they would then choose others like them. It would be not like a pyramid scheme, but it would act like a pyramid. A few people at the top would pick people they know to be excellent, those people would pick the ones they know to be excellent, and so forth and so on. This is probably a top 2% or 1% of the population by ability. They will not necessarily be wealthy. In fact, they're not the kind of person who makes a whole lot of money because they're not fascinated by money. They are driven by virtue, a desire to be excellent, and to do the best they can, not just for others as individuals, but for the culture, the group, and the civilization, such that the organic whole is valued more than any individual member. They are the people who cultivate a civilization much as you would cultivate a garden or a population of animals. They reward the good, they punish the bad, and they do things that are sensible. They make sensible laws, if they make any laws, and they intervene when people are doing things regardless of legal state. They have absolute power. But when someone is doing something wrong, they intervene and stop it, and when someone is doing something good, they reward them. And so, for example, if we had in this country enough impetus behind this, we could create a constitutional amendment, appoint our initial aristocracy, have them appoint the others, and then have the rest of government essentially make recommendations to them and or possibly oversee certain areas that are specific to modernity, like industry and finance, such that they could implement those in the way that a manager would, because that is the kind of task that suits a managerial discipline. It would require a large change, but I don't think it's as large as people think it has to be. There is perhaps 1 in 20 people in this world, in Western civilization as it is now, who have exceptional ability and tend to be the ones who are natural leaders in any environment. They know how to do things, they're known for their quality of judgment, and these are the people who, when they are convinced of the need for a change, tend to agitate for it, and others tend to follow them, because they have already distinguished themselves as natural leaders. If that conversion happens, it will be relatively easy to amend our government such that we can graft a monarchy on top of it, and then give that monarchy the power it needs to avoid being subverted by that government.
I guess a question a lot of people have that I still have is, what kind of checks and balances would there be for this kind of power? Since there would not be a democratic process in place, what would the selection process look like, the determination of this? Like, when we talk about a monarchy, we think of one linear line, one bloodline. Like, this would be a little different. This would be a different form of monarchy, would it not? It would be a form of radical meritocracy. Like, how would this take form exactly?
Truly, to do an aristocracy, you do not have a meritocracy. Meritocracy generally involves starting everyone out as equals, and then you apply tests to them and make them jump through hoops to prove themselves. What you would do with this, I would make it hereditary because all traits are hereditary. You would look at the people who have distinguished themselves by acting not in their own self-interest alone, but in doing things that enhance our civilization and in fighting back against the decay we've seen here, and have otherwise done things that benefit everyone, not necessarily equally, but by having a functional and healthy civilization, everyone is able to partake in that and enjoy the benefits of function. And so there are people striving toward this every day who do good things, who clearly are driven by virtue and clearly have superior force of moral character and force of intellect, as Alfred J. Knox says. And you would select these people and make them part of your hereditary aristocracy. As far as checks and balances, this is an informal system. So we do not have written checks and balances, but what you do have is horizontal and vertical hierarchy within your aristocracy. That is, you have some at the top from whom a king may be chosen, and you have a cascade of lesser lords who rule regions, and then below that, they rule local areas. And from these, you can select, if they act in an exceptional way, you can bump them up a level over time. But you're basically going to select people who are competent and then have them informally keep an eye on each other and discuss these things. Instead of taking a vote, which goes to whatever is most popular and therefore everyone compromises, they debate it to the end and they come to conclusions. And this is more like a social group where people are trained since birth to rule. They have the exceptional ability to rule, as we've already seen. They're driven by virtue, they have strong force of character and force of intellect, and therefore they're going to be able to understand these things on a higher level and convince each other of what must necessarily be done. So this would be more like a hunting club or a military group, in that while you have rank, anyone in charge is going to defer, in some cases, to those below them and also to those horizontal to them. On either side of them, meaning people of roughly the same rank who are from different areas or different specializations, and they are going to resolve debates the old-fashioned way, which is by coming to a conclusion instead of just getting to a compromise and then declaring that good enough and going home. This does not sound very compelling until you consider the fact that for these aristocrats, it is a life sentence to be in these positions, and the only way they succeed is by making their society, making their civilization succeed and making it better. And for that reason, they're going to rely heavily on the judgment of their peers, and they're going to be willing to engage in lengthy debates about things to get to a right answer and a clear answer, as opposed to one that merely flatters most of the people in the group.
Building upon that, we mentioned a form of hierarchy in this system. So, with essentially, what would that kind of look like? When you have lords that are looking over a region and everybody is sort of beneath this would be sort of a form of anarchy. How do you sort of stratify that when we talk about hierarchy? Are we talking about stratification in that sense?
When I speak of hierarchy in this context, I'm speaking of social hierarchy, meaning you will have a caste system. That is, you're going to break people into general bands by ability, and you're going to place the ones who are of greater ability toward the top. That's going to interface with your aristocracy. But instead of having a class system where we decide whoever has the most money deserves to have the most wealth and power, we're going to take good people and make sure that they have enough influence to shape our culture and to do the right thing in every situation. I'm thinking about your local neighborhood. You will want people there who are acknowledged as above others. And then we will defer to them to solve problems and defer to them for their wisdom and follow their example, such that instead of going with whatever most people decide is the right idea, you know, everyone's buying cheap junk at Walmart, so you got to keep up. Instead, you have a smaller group of people that you imitate. I'm a large fan of the manorial system, whereby you have estates run by people of the higher castes, and they employ people to work on those estates and essentially rent property to them to live on and manage their sources of income to some degree. So this means you're taking your people who are not just cynical bosses trying to squeeze the last buck out of you, but are interested in the well-being of civilization as a whole and all the people in it, and they are going to then administrate these estates such that people of lesser ability are not required to make decisions that they are not equipped to do.
You were speaking about jobs, bosses. I know you read about a lot about anti-work, which is a big one, that jobs are jails, essentially. And so I guess this comes back to sort of a transcendental outlook. How do we redefine purpose in a system like this, where most people derive purpose from, you know, job, passion, education, just come on this linear system of life? What would transcendental purpose look like under a system like this?
Transcendental purpose means that you want to do what is good, excellent, beautiful, accurate, honest, prideful, and generally improve your civilization such that it is the best that it can be. We're leaving the universal context behind, where we think that there is something common to all of humanity that we can strive for. Instead, because this is culture rule, you are looking only to exhibit the qualities that this civilization has had in the past, to improve upon them qualitatively, meaning make them better without changing what they are. For example, an athlete performs the same sport time and time again, but improves each time through many, many details as they look at their performance and are able to figure out how to do it better. They're not changing what they're doing, they're changing to some degree how they're doing it. But it's in the details as opposed to changing direction entirely. Transcendental purpose would be the root of this society, which would be aiming for virtue and aiming for upholding the tenets of its culture, but not so much in an administrative sense as exhibiting them in ourselves from our inner traits outward, meaning we're going to get our souls right with the purpose of this society, with reality and how nature is, and with any form of metaphysical or divine that we believe in. And I think inevitably people tend to believe in something good about this world because basically we believe life is good. And so when you put all of those things together, you have multiple parallels in which people are acting out the same basic impulse, an inner impulse to do well, to do good, more than to succeed in terms of money, to make sure we make the world a beautiful place, we make our civilization great, we make its artifacts wonderful, we make it awe-inspiring, we make people feel reverent toward life itself because they believe in its value and that it is a wonderful thing. We say about conservatives that we conserve the best of the past, and this implies two things. First, that we look at the past and see what has succeeded and what has not. And second, that on top of that, we then judge what has succeeded the best, what has produced the best results, and what has given people a vision to the transcendental, made them feel a connection to life, and made them feel as if their existence here was not so much material as a pursuit of virtue and a pursuit of understanding, a desire to live within the confines of nature and make the best of it that we can, instead of constantly fighting our inner nature and fighting the rules of the natural world such that we leave behind giant heaps of landfill. It's an entirely different view. Our current society is materialistic in the sense that we have material goals, and based on material accomplishments, we justify things as good or not. We're going to cut out the middleman and just go to what is good. And good is defined as it applies to the organic whole, which is the civilization as if it were a living thing, and nature as if it were a living thing. This viewpoint eschews the Western tendency of late to view nature as something of an error, of randomness, and not of beauty. Instead, we accept the beauty in nature and its order, and we use it to work for us, and we find a way to understand it, because only then can we appreciate the beauty of our world. And so that is the transcendental outlook, and it is entirely different than the material, but at the same time, it will produce in the long term better results. Our society is caught up in constant cycles of creation and destruction and waste, and people's lives are wasted at jobs, and their hopes are crushed. Instead, we want to give them hope and give them a purpose and a way to feel good about themselves, because instead of saying, oh, well, I earned this amount of money, you're saying, no, I'm a person of this society. I exhibit its values, and I have improved upon them in the following way, and I've expressed them in these ways, and therefore I am good because I am pursuing virtue. And that's what you're giving to people. You're giving them a chance to become everyday heroes.
So I'd like to sort of move into one thing that we don't have on our pillars here, but just to touch upon nationalism briefly as well. So, you know, we recognize different sort of subsets of white nationalism. Some people are just all out Aryan supremacy, let's just genocide global population, and then we'll just realize perfection here. But we're, our sort of viewpoint is, okay, let's take a more pan-nationalist approach. Like, what would this sort of look like? We're talking in the immediate sense of, okay, we realize a society in the United States where we do away with multiculturalism and we put in the system in place. What would the rest of the world look like in that regard?
Well, as the saying goes, that's their decision. We can set up a system that works for us, and that is only our concern. We are not here to fix the rest of the world or tell them how to live. They're going to find systems for themselves. Then again, as history goes, whatever system is succeeding is emulated, usually by other people. So pan-nationalism means basically nationalism for everybody. It's different from white nationalism and other forms of modern interpretations of nationalism that are basically me first and screw everybody else. This is instead saying we recognize that every group has a need to exist and to control its future. Even more, we recognize that it has a self-interest, and this self-interest means it wants to make itself stable as a civilization, it wants to make itself the best civilization that it can be, and this entails, to some degree, suppressing others around it. They must be in charge of their own lands, and they must be in charge of their own destiny. And this is why diversity, or multiculturalism, causes endless conflict. Every group is trying to dominate the other, because only when they dominate the others are they safe from the others. And so this catches us in an ugly loop. Pan-nationalism instead says, we are not going to take a viewpoint of enmity toward others, but on the other hand, we're going to recognize that their interests and ours will never overlap. And it is a fallacy to expect them to do so, and part of the reason we're irritated with other groups is because they're here among us and they're acting in their self-interest, not what we perceive as our shared self-interest, which actually doesn't exist because it's based on the idea of universalism or all people being the same, which has always been a fantasy. We're not equal, we're different, and we value our differences, and we value them not just as individuals, as families, as castes, but as groups. And so white nationalism tries to do away with that, and some forms of nationalism try to do away with that, but pan-nationalism says the interests of European people, our nationalism, is the same as Zionism, and is the same as Black Power, and is the same as Aztlan, and other groups that are just striving for their own autonomy and control of their own future. They want to control their destiny, and this is reasonable. So instead of fighting that, we acknowledge it and say every group is going to need to lead itself, and it's going to need to have control of its own future such that it's going to need to be independent from all others. So pan-nationalism is basically, let's unite by not uniting. We're all going to act in our own interest. We're going to stop trying to control each other. We're not going to have a situation where one group has a historical hold on another through guilt. We're not going to look back to history and say, this is what I'm owed. Instead, we're going to say everyone is going their own way, and it is up to them to run themselves the way they want to, because that's going to be specific to who they are and to their culture and to what their values are and what they're going to need to do in order to become the best version of the people they are.
I mean, when we look at people like Richard Spencer or Andrew Anglin, what advice do you have for them in the path that they're taking right now, and just the audiences that they go through? I mean, Richard Spencer's obviously, he caters to a more lax crowd, got the support of people like Jared Taylor, who we had on our podcast recently. What would you say to that crowd, and what would you say to circles like the Daily Stormer, where they're saying, okay, well, if the Jewish problem were to cease to exist, then we wouldn't have degeneracy in the world, and we wouldn't have all this influence against the white interests? I mean,
let's separate those out. There's the JQ, which we probably should talk about because it always comes up. And then there's other leaders and what we might tell them. And my answer is, I really think they should just keep doing what they're doing and follow their destiny. My interest is not in controlling them. I think Richard Spencer is doing a great job of getting the word out at a very basic level, understanding that we're going to have to start with baby steps. We're going to have to introduce people to the idea that nationalism is legitimate. We're going to have to introduce people to the idea that ethnic groups can have self-interest, including white ethnic groups. He's also spreading a lot of doubt about democracy and the way that people tend to think in groups, the group think that humans are all prone to. He is doing an excellent job with that, and I see no reason why anyone should really interfere with that. I mean, I say, keep doing it, you're doing a great job. As far as Andrew Anglin, he is a fantastic writer. He's hilarious. He's brought a lot of people in, and it may be that that's the introduction that they need to get into the alt-right. Now, we all have our own paths, and we work in parallel, and we're going to eventually converge on the same truths. Along the way, there's lots of different steps, some of which are going to seem contradictory, as we try to get really a sea change understood by a lot of our people. At least that top 2-5%, but even many more we'd like to have on board with us. So there's going to be some internal friction. There's going to be some chaos. We're going to explore different avenues toward these philosophies. We're going to explore different flavors of them. And it's essential that we do that. So right now it's good that we're all working in parallel, even if we don't really agree on a whole hell of a lot in some instances, on some issues. Jared Taylor is another excellent person to mention. He covers a lot of issues, and he speaks less on others. And I think that's great. He has found an area of expertise, and he is awakening people every day to what they need to know about that. So, in that sense, I think it's wonderful that these people are doing what they're doing, and I think we need to have this kind of internal dialogue. It's very helpful. And along the way, we're seeing really the best of people come out across the board. And it's not just the Richard Spencers, Andrew Anglins, and Jared Taylors. There's other people like Peter Brimelow who are doing great stuff. There's Stephen Clay McGahee, who's writing great stuff on his thecivilright.org website. There are many people out there working with us now. They're all going to approach this from a slightly different angle, and they're going to have slightly different values. But really what that's doing is getting us on the same page, talking about the same things, and getting other people who are outside of us talking about those same things, whether they come in by being shocked and appalled and then laughing, as they might on the Daily Stormer, or just finding the appeal in Richard Spencer's calm, reasoned approach to these dialogues, where he points out the contradictions in our current thinking, or even just going through Jared Taylor's or Peter Brimelow's much more race-centric, race-realist, human biodiversity viewpoint. All of those are going to be valuable, and so I think it's good that we have this dialogue. In the name of having this dialogue, we should talk about the JQ. For me, the JQ, the Jewish question, is the wrong question. The real question, because we are the conquerors, because we are the race that has achieved so much for ourselves over many centuries, many millennia, the real question to us is how do we restore Western civilization? And that implicates the question, where did we go wrong? And I do not believe that a small group did this to us. I don't believe an external group did this to us. We did this to us. In the course of becoming successful and encountering many threats and struggles, such as the Mongol invasions, the plagues, the Islamic invasions, and many other events that really thwarted us in the past, we have become decadent, and we have forgotten our original principle of virtue and the need to do what is right for civilization as an organic whole. We've focused too much on individualism, which is the idea of me first before virtue and before any values and before the values of my civilization. And to empower that, we have switched to this notion of egalitarianism, or that all people are equal, which is basically anarchy with grocery stores, and that forgets that we need social order, and as a result we've neglected social order. And so now anyone who speaks of virtue is basically seen as an outer space alien who's too stupid to converse with, and we might say that's Dunning-Kruger effect in action, and that could well be true. But really, in order to feel power over our future, we have to admit responsibility for where we went wrong and the bad decisions we made, and we have to fix those bad decisions. And whether or not the Jewish people, or some of the Jewish people, were involved in our downfall, it is only because we allowed them to do so, because we were already degenerate. And there is no point scapegoating them, because that's going to lead us away from the solution that we need, which is to fix our own behavior. This is like anything else. You get too fat, you go on a diet. You get addicted to heroin, you stop doing heroin. You find yourself having trouble at work, you assess how you've been going about things, and you change your method. And that is what we need to do for the West. We need to remember that our goal is to restore Western civilization by rediscovering virtue and then enhancing it. We are going to take all of the old values, come to understand them, and then amplify them and nurture this civilization back to health and make it great again. And no amount of blaming someone else can ever bring us to that point. In fact, it takes us away from that point. And it's also going to take us toward dangerous things. If you killed every Jew in the world tomorrow, Western civilization would still be degenerate. And that's not going to help anybody. And then you're going to become murderers. The National Socialists, I think, if they had a chance to look back over history, would say that they would not have preferred to be murderers. In fact, that was a mistake. It is one thing to say people who don't belong among us because they belong to a different culture need to go back home. And I am a strong advocate of that, to a point that many people would say is extremist. But that is not blaming them. That's saying that no two cultures can exist in the same place. No two civilizations can occupy the same land. We need our own civilization, and we need to do it without murdering people. The problem with JQ rhetoric is that it leads people to scapegoat and channel all of their anger not toward our bad decisions, not toward the bad ideas we've got floating around, but toward a group of people, and that will lead to murder. And after that murder, we're going to find ourselves sitting around saying, why didn't this fix our problem? And then we're going to have a double problem, because then not only are we going to be murderers, but we're also still going to have our behavior unchanged as it was that led us to this state. So we need to not worry about symptoms, and we need to not worry about other things that are going wrong. We need to go to the core of the symptoms, strike at the neck of the Hydra, not the heads, and fix that. And that's going to first be a war of ideas, where we come to understand what it is we have to do, and next it's going to be a war of work, where we dismantle all of the bad things we've done and rebuild not just a system, we're rebuilding a civilization. And so that's a lot harder than killing Jews. And so I have a lot of, I guess, empathy for people who want to believe in the JQ. It would make everything easy if it were so simple as murdering people, but it ain't. And I apologize for shattering your dreams, but we have a lot of work ahead of us, and we have some hard questions to decide. We have some things we have to face in our own souls. And we're not going to be able to do that simply through external acts. We're going to have to get good with ourselves, and we're going to have to become good. And then, as Richard Spencer says, we're going to have to become who we are, who we always have been, for millennia, for centuries. We are Western civilization. We are Western people. We hold ourselves to a higher standard than this, and we're going to stop our bad behavior and rise to that standard again, and then push it further. The stars await.
Let's talk about the last one as well. Let's talk about quality. We talk about quality. We're talking about quality of people, and we're talking about some form of stratification for this as well in society. Like, what would that look like?
Well, we would have our social hierarchy or our caste system, but even more, we would change our thinking such that we were looking toward the quality of our actions and the quality of people. Quality of actions means it's not just enough to do a minimum. If you're going to achieve something, it's going to be measured not just by meeting, as in meritocracy, a few standards that someone else has set out. You are instead going to aim for making the best possible thing that you can, and whoever makes the best is going to rise above others, and then we're all going to be ranked by the quality of what we have done. This is how humans naturally behave, but in an administrative system, a managerial system, we've forgotten that, because instead we're just trying to please our bosses by doing what they've written down on sheets of paper. And so that's your assessment of act quality and how that determines people quality. And from that, it will be easy to achieve a hierarchy within society, where each of us has a caste rank. And generally, in Western civilization, there have been three castes. There's your jarls, who are your aristocrats, your religious leaders, your intellectual leaders. There's your carls, who are your artisans and warriors, and to some degree, people who manage things like shops. And then at the very bottom, you have your thralls, who are people who need to be told what to do. Jarls know what to do, carls need to be given general direction, thralls need to be told what to do. Within the thralls, there is your mercantile group. And this group, if not restrained, will turn your society into a giant shopping mall. They are essentially people who are driven purely by insect-style stimulus response. They like money, they find importance in it, and they like to run shops and run businesses, but they don't do so in such a way that brings out the best qualities of your population or the best quality of your civilization. And so you need this social hierarchy so that when someone comes up with a new bright idea, like, you know, I'm going to sell glitter-encrusted dildos to children, you have someone saying, well, I outrank you here in our social order, and I think that's a terrible idea, and even though I'm sure you'll make lots of money selling it, you can't do it. And aristocrats play into that because the Jarl order overlaps with the aristocrats. Again, this is an informal order. Instead of having lots of meetings and paperwork and people bloviating on about various rules, you have a simple common sense goal. Is this of good quality? Does this uphold our culture? And is this going to lead to the greater health of our organic civilization? And so it really is a different outlook, and it's very hard for modern people to wrap their heads around it, and I recommend just taking some time to think about it for all you out there in radio land, because you're switching away from an order based on setting goals that are based on minimums, such as you need to sell a certain number of products this month, or you need a certain amount of money. Instead, you're assessing the quality of the results of what you do. It is wholly consequentialist. Did selling glitter-encrusted dildos to children improve society? Did it bring about the inner virtue in people? Did it make them better versions of who they are, or didn't it? It's a yes or no question at first. Was this good or bad? And then for the good, you look at, well, how good was it? Was this really, really excellent, or do we need to keep improving on this? And the way you improve things qualitatively is lots of little adjustments. It's what the Japanese call kaizen. It is gradual improvement at every level through the details. And with this, you're able to take a basic idea that's right, and instead of casting about for a new idea every time, like, oh, we need a new thing, a new trend, a new fad, a new mania, you instead say, we're going to take what we're doing, and we're just going to improve its quality. We're going to improve the results based by just lots of little modifications to it. And so quality is an entirely different outlook than the minimums-based administrative and managerial order that we have now.
Well, with that, I hope this lets some perspective for our audience and for newcomers as well to the alt-right. Leave comments, any questions that we have, we'll do our best to answer it. And you can also join us on our Discord as well at America. And with that, it'll be Brett Stevens and I, James Price, signing off.
Thank you.